So the first thing I wanted to discuss with you is the topic of UFOs and aliens. Can we just dismiss the topic by saying, where is the evidence?
Well, that's we could technically, but really there's two different questions on the table with aliens and UFOs. The first is, are they out there somewhere? And the second, have they come here? So to the first question, of course, this is what SETI scientists, professional astronomers and physicists are working on. They're trying to detect signals from space using radio telescopes, or they're looking for traces of past advanced civilizations, such as, for example, a Dyson type sphere or massive solar panels around a star that could be used to capture more energy from the sun of that particular civilization, those sorts of things. Now, so far, it's come up negative. But as they like to say, in this case, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, because we've hardly looked anywhere. There's on the order of several hundred billion stars in our galaxy. There's probably upwards of a trillion stars in the Milky Way, in the known universe. So at that, we just have to remain agnostic and keep searching. The second question, though, the one that interests UFO people, and it's a completely separate community of people. The UFO community is largely not consisting of scientists, physicists, astronomers, and so on. It's mostly just kind of amateur, curious people that call themselves researchers or investigative journalists or whatever. But they really have no, most of them have no training in science, how it works. And as it's clear from reading their literature and watching their documentaries, they're starting with the assumption that aliens have come here. We know they've come here. Now let's just try to find evidence of it. Now, of course, they know better than to say that. They'll say something like, oh, I don't know, I'm just asking some curious questions here about this mysterious lights in the sky, or this little blob thing that was captured on camera, and so on. But when you get to know them and you read the literature, it's clear they already believe. And so in science, you're not supposed to start with the conclusion, even though a lot of scientists do, because they're human. But at least how it's conducted, you have to remain open to the possibility that you're wrong. And in fact, science begins with the null hypothesis that your hypothesis is wrong until you prove otherwise. And the burden of proof is on the claimant, not on the skeptics or the scientific community to disprove the claim. So, if you ask, can you prove that aliens have never come here to Earth? Of course I can't. How would you do that? But the burden of proof isn't on me to do that. It's on you, the claimant, to show me the evidence you have. And so far, the evidence is just crummy. It's just so thin that by the principle of ICRA, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, made famous by Carl Sagan, although said by originally by Marcello Truzzi, which is really just an expression of Hume's principle of proportionality, that we should proportion our confidence and our beliefs to the evidence. And so the idea that aliens have come here is an extraordinary claim. How extraordinary is the evidence? It's not even ordinary. It's really crappy. Blurry photographs, grainy videos, and lots of stories about things that go bump in the night when people are out camping or wandering around in the desert or whatever. So, and it's really simple. I would believe everybody, all scientists and skeptics would believe if there was concrete evidence. So we already have a model of how this works in biology. If you want to name a new species, you have to have a type specimen, an actual physical example of the species, and you can bring it to the conference and photograph it, put it in a museum. It can be dissected, it's photographed and published in peer-reviewed journals, and everybody can see it. So if the UFO people had something like that, an actual spacecraft. Now, of course, the rebuttal to that is, oh, it's it, they're being hidden away by the government. So this hidden evidence argument, that's not an argument. If you took that to a biology conference and said, I found a bipedal primate living in the hinterlands of Canada, call him Bigfoot or Yeti, they'd say, that's nice. Let's see it. Oh, well, it's being hidden by the Canadian government. It's in this warehouse where they're keeping the aliens. Okay, whatever. That you'd just be laughed off the stage. That's not evidence. Okay, so to that, then, you know, of course it's possible aliens have come here sometime in the past, but the evidence for it is pretty thin.
So when I sent you my notes about these topics I wanted to discuss, my starting point was those three articles from the New York Times. And when I read them at the beginning, well, I just read the headlines, as most people do when they read tweets and so on, which is probably a problem, right? People just read the headlines. And then I read the full articles and I said, whoa, that looks like someone is confirming there are UFOs and these UFOs are actual alien spacecrafts. But then I started doing some fact check. And the first thing I noticed is that the author of these articles is a ufologist.
Leslie Keen, yeah. I read her book. It's a fine book. It's interesting. It's just a series of anecdotes. And the fact that the anecdotes are coming from, you know, military leaders, generals, you know, police captains, government officials, whatever, is irrelevant, because they're not any better at observing than anybody else. And their word is no more trustworthy than anybody else's. So why believe them? It's amazing that she got that published in the New York Times, because to the average reader, that's a New York Times fact-checked article conducted by a journalist. But that's not what it is. It's written by somebody who already believes in aliens having come here. And so that's a little deceptive, as for the claims themselves, you know, I think the best analysis comes from, well, we've published a couple pieces in Skeptic on this, but the actual camera analysis is conducted by Mick West, M-I-C-K, Mick West. So if you look up his Twitter feed, and then that takes you to his articles, or just his articles on his website, he shows that the tic-tac a UFO, or what really is obviously a balloon hurtling along, and it looks like it's hauling ass at, you know, like 1,000 miles an hour or more, when in fact it's not. That it's an artifact of how the camera is rotating, and he shows through clever analysis that, you know, what looks like this so-called UFO accelerating at incredible speed is just the camera being zoomed in or zoomed out at high speed. You know, the camera itself is causing the visual effects in the film, not the object itself. And he shows that when the camera zooms or rotates, the entire environment around the UFO is rotating the exact same way that the UFO is. So it's an artifact of the video, not the object that's being chased. So it doesn't matter if the jet pilot says, oh my God, oh, look at that. Oh, dude, unbelievable. It's irrelevant. Or they give an interview later saying, I'm an expert on detecting other space, other craft in my space, and I've never seen anything like that. Okay. So what? you're not seeing what you think you're seeing, you know, and the headlines read as if the government is confirming that aliens are here. When all they did was confirm that they had a program, you know, poorly funded by government standards anyway, that concluded nothing. I mean, we keep hearing now, by the way, that footage is not new. They keep saying, oh, it's brand new, just released. You know, this is from 15 years ago. Okay, come on, give it to us. If, you know, quit saying we're about to release this huge discovery. Okay, what is it? Because skeptics want to know.
Those footages, one of them is from 2004, and I think Commander Fravor was part of it, in the sense that he was in the fighter jet, and the other ones were from 2014, 2015. Now, these footages were released by Luis Elizondo in 2017. Luis Elizondo is the main protagonist of these articles, and he says that he resigned from some government office in 2017 because he wasn't happy with the way that the UFO business was dealt with within the government. And so what the article, Leslie Keen article, doesn't say is that Elizondo joins a company which is called To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, which was founded by
Tom DeLonge, yeah. A rock star, you know. Yeah, I mean, nothing wrong with that. Outsiders could make contributions to science, but come on, you know.
The weird thing is that how come there is a government official, apparently, that can freely release information from the government and that doesn't get prosecuted? Like, we know what happened to Assange, we know what happened to Chelsea Manning, right, and so on.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yes, that's a very good point, right? If they were releasing something that was real or that was important, yeah, that they'd get the same treatment that Julian Assange or, you know, have gotten. So, and they haven't. So I'm sure the people in the government are like, oh God, that again.
Yeah.
let them run with it because we're busy with other things, you know, over here.
And so this guy apparently he lied when he said that he was leading the program you mentioned, which is the Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program, which was actually funded by Senator Harry Reid for $22 million. And so he said he was the director, when there is the spokesperson from the Pentagon that said he wasn't directing this program. So in that case, he lied about that. And so they go ahead with this To the Stars Academy, whatever, which was founded by this Tom DeLonge, but also by a physicist who also worked as a parapsychologist and expert of paranormal activities in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was a project made famous in the film Men Who Stare at Goats, based on the book by John Ronson that tracks that whole history. Yeah. So George Clooney, right, where, you know, they were testing remote viewing. So you'd have these, you know, psychics that are, you know, in a basement somewhere in a quiet room, you know, that's soundproof, and they have these ping pong balls over their eyes so that they can't see anything. And then they have to try to envision where the missile silos are in Siberia or whatever. And so this went on for decades, and they spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars. Now, you know, to the average listener like you and I, that sounds like a lot of money. But by government standards, you know, that's the cost overrun on a single stretch of highway, paving a highway or so. It's nothing, right? It's particularly over many years. So, and it's okay that, you know, that governments, you know, try this or that. I mean, that program, Stargate, was inspired by the so-called psi gap. Remember the missile gap? Well, then there was alleged psychic gap when we found out that the Russians were testing ESP to try to make these kind of psychic soldiers. You know, it wasn't clear back in the, you know, 50s and 60s that this was impossible. You know, scientists had yet to really run a lot of controlled experiments to show that there's nothing to this. And so why not? Okay, spend a little money just in case, you know. But after negative results for, you know, for 10 years, then you dump it. And the same thing with the you know, the threat, aerial threat phenomenon program. You know, okay, so if enough reports come in that, you know, there's spooky things in our airspace, well, that's the military's job, is to investigate those things. Okay, fine, go investigate it. But, you know, why drag it out for years and years with these little teasing articles in the New York Times, like, ooh, this is going to be huge, going to be big. Just give it to us. Come on. If it's Russian or Chinese or North Korean or extraterrestrial, you know, skeptics want to know. Everybody wants to know. And this idea that, you know, the stock market would crash and the economy, you know, would collapse and people would lose their minds and go, and this is wrong. This is not true. You know, people do not lose their minds and go crazy when there's incidences like that. So, yeah. So we want to know.
Yeah. And so To the Stars Academy and Tom DeLonge, they produced a documentary called Unidentified. That was released on the History Channel. It's also available on Amazon Prime.
Yeah,
and where Elizondo is the star. He appears as an investigator that goes and interviews people. And all the evidence is anecdotal. It doesn't show any actual thing. So my question, after seeing all these things, the documentary and so on, do you think these articles, I mean, the initial articles were a sort of PR campaign for whatever entertainment is going on with the To the Stars Academy or maybe other?
Well, not just entertainment, but they also have some investments you can make in their private company, and they advertise that on their webpage. That's always made me a little suspicious. Like, you know, why are you asking people for money? You know, that's starting to sound kind of cultish, even though apparently they're not doing anything illegal. But why mix them? You know, if you want to start a private company, go ahead, but don't mix up this kind of general scientific question of possibility of extraterrestrial visitation or whatever with that. And so, to me, that taints their. It's like the old, you know, tobacco companies funding research on cigarette smoking and lung cancer. You know, it's obvious there's a potential conflict of interest.
So I was trying to understand what could be other explanations of. I mean, what was shown in the video. And you said maybe it's a balloon, it could be an artifact, an illusion. Or could it be that it's some Russians or Chinese drones or something? Or is that too much?
Yeah, well, I think it's probably not even that, although that would be important to know. So, okay, give it to us.
Another option that we can discuss later, it could be that this is a cover-up to hide some U.S. military technology.
Yeah, but again, that's always a hand-waving explanation for people who don't have evidence. You know, we know it's there, and the reason we know it's there is because they're hiding the evidence. This very much reminds me of George Bush's response to when the search teams went into Iraq to find the weapons of mass destruction, and they couldn't find any. And the initial response by the Bush administration was, well, they moved them. That's how we know they had them. Because we have no evidence for it. It's like, wait a minute, that's not an argument. In fact, that's what the UFO people say. You know, where's the Roswell bodies in the spacecraft? Oh, they moved them. That's how we know they're there. What?
Maybe we can discuss about the US technology later, but now I wanted to discuss about Bob Lazar. Have you seen the podcast with Joe Rogan? Do you think that guy is lying, or do you think he's telling the truth? What do you think?
Well, I don't think he's telling the truth. Maybe it's his truth at this point. You have to remember the power of self-deception. Now, so I can't get inside somebody's heart or head or whatever, and you know, to any cult leader or whatever, do they really believe the stuff they're saying? Maybe they believe it, but that doesn't make it true. So whether Bob Lazar, you know, is totally deluded or he's just making stuff up, I don't know. But for sure, people that have fact-checked his claims. And don't take my word for it as a skeptic. Take Stan Friedman's word for it. Stan Friedman was, he just died last year, and a really good guy. Even though he and I collided on TV many times over UFOs, he's a total UFO believer. Absolutely, they've come here. Now, to his credit, he's never had any personal experiences, never been abducted, never seen a UFO. He just thinks that the evidence is sufficient to draw that conclusion. So when he heard the Bob Lazar story, he fact-checked it. So Lazar said he went to MIT and to Caltech. No, he didn't. And in fact, he had the equivalent of like a couple physics classes at a community college. And that's it. And Stan was able to track that down. But, you know, the records at Caltech and MIT show no Bob Lazar. So Lazar's explanation for that is, well, because it's top secret and what I was doing was so important and what I found out was so revelatory that they erased the records. At those universities. Okay, I'm sorry. That's not how it works. No government can go into MIT or Caltech and tell them, we'd like you to, you know, scrape clean the records of this particular student here. They're not going to do it. It's totally illegal. And, you know, and universities, they really, really protect, you know, student records. And, you know, so, but again, even the argument itself is another one of these hand-waving arguments.
But he said that he worked at Los Alamos.
Well, then that, okay. So Friedman said, okay, if he's going to lie about something so easy to check as a student record, and so readily falsifiable, and you know, and there's no record at Los Alamos other than this one little thing that he worked as like a contract laborer for some little department that did nothing. But this idea that he worked in this top secret department that, you know, worked on alien spacecraft, he's just making that up, or he's deluded. So again, the idea that there's a line of demarcation between science and pseudoscience that normally scientists are trying to find when they're investigating a particular claim, some alternative medicine claim or whatever. And this is how science works. You want to just test it. That line of demarcation is where when you hit it to the point where there's no way to test it. There's no way to find out if it's just an assertion. And as Christopher Hitchens liked to say, that which can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence, full stop. Okay. So when it's not just skeptics drawing the line of demarcation saying that's just pseudoscience, that's just nonsense, it's bullshit, but your own people, okay, ufologists who are believers say, nope, that guy is full of crap. He did not do what he said he did. That tells you how far out, when even your own team says you're full of shit. You saw this with the 9/11 truthers. You know, there's different grades of 9/11 truthism. And, you know, there's those who say, you know, there were no planes. They were all like, 3D holograms or, you know, whatever. Well, the normal 9/11 truthers, they go, wait a minute, that's a bunch of bullshit. Of course, there were planes, but the planes were remotely controlled. And then other 9/11 truthers go, no, that's a bullshit story. You know, here's what really happened. And so when they're debunking themselves, that shows you how far out on the fringe they are.
But it's not all bullshit about the 9/11 truthers, because there are people suing actually the Saudi government, for example, for a conspiracy.
So here's a good example of what we mean by skepticism. You know, are you skeptical of global warming, or are you skeptical of the global warming skeptics? Okay, so it's not just a thing that you are as a skeptic all the time, not believing anything. We all believe lots of things. So I am skeptical of the conspiracy theory that 9/11 was an inside job by the Bush administration, but I'm not skeptical that it was a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy. You know, 19 members of Al-Qaeda plotting to fly planes into buildings without telling us. That's a conspiracy. And we know it was orchestrated by Osama bin Laden and so on. And, you know, apparently, funded by Saudi Arabia. Okay. Or at least, you know, some of the hijackers themselves were backed by the Saudi government. Anyway, the point is, you know, there are real conspiracies that of which conspiracy theories are true, and other conspiracies are false. That is, the conspiracy is not real that they claim. So it depends on each one.
So going back to Bob Lazar, you mentioned that, yeah, of course he didn't go to Caltech and MIT, but apparently he worked to Los Alamos. So if we assume that he worked at Los Alamos, there is no way you can get there without a degree. So maybe made up that he had a degree in order to get there.
Yes, okay. But again, we're going further down the rabbit hole of hand-waving to erase, distract from the fact that, you know, that there's no evidence for these claims. It's possible he faked his degree in order to get a job there, something like that, and that they were hoodwinked about that. Now, that seems unlikely given how careful government agencies are, but we know from history that they have been duped by imposters. Corporations have. Government agencies have, individuals have. It happens, yes, but that doesn't make it true.
So the other thing that these Bob Lazar believers bring as a proof that he was right was the element 115. Moscovium, he says, oh, he predicted the element.
Yeah. Actually, well, he says he predicted.
Yeah, I mean, the element, there were papers before he mentioned it talking about the potential properties of this element 115, which was after discovered in 2004. So that thing doesn't mean anything.
Again, it's just an assertion. Where's the spacecraft? Come on, dude. That is the most extraordinary claim in this area that anyone's ever made. I saw the spacecraft myself. All right, where is it? Well, like they've hidden it or they've erased it. You know, I used to make this argument with Stan Friedman too, because, you know, we're on Larry King Live together, and he's holding up these government documents with big blacked out paragraphs. He goes, "See, here's the evidence." It's like, what's the evidence? I just see a blacked out paragraph. I don't know what am I looking at. You're looking at the evidence that I'm claiming is in there. It's like, but I can't see it, and you can't see it. You don't know that. You know, and so in science, again, to test a claim, there has to be some way to get at it, to falsify it, that you can do it and I can do it. And, we can all look at it and see it and see the results and replicate it and so on. It's one of the problems of the replication crisis we're going through now is that, you know, some of those standards were lowered or hacked a little bit under the publisher parish pressures and so on. So yes, that does happen, but it's always the scientists themselves that catch, you know, the errors, the fraud, the mistakes and so on. You know, almost never outsiders. It's almost always an insider, you know, graduate student that sees some shenanigans going on with the principal primary investigator and principal investigator and then blows the whistle. That's why we have whistleblower laws. But the fact that has happened doesn't mean that it happens all the time and it happened in your particular case that you want to claim.
Another thing about Bob Lazar, he claims that this layered triangle of Moscovium is able to generate gravity. And thanks to this thing, then the spacecraft can fly and all these things. So he said that this material can exist naturally, but that's I mean, so far, the moscovium that was synthesized can only last 0.6 seconds or something. I can't remember, a fraction of a second. So far, we haven't found any of this moscovium existing in nature, but that doesn't mean that it has the properties that it talks about. So another thing that they say, okay, Bob Lazar was right. If you look at the gimbal video, let's assume it's a spacecraft. Okay, that spacecraft flies in the same way that Bob Lazar described it. But I think, is that a coincidence?
Yeah, I forgot about the gimbal thing and Bob Lazar. Yeah. Again, this is kind of after-the-fact reasoning, you know, where someone like him will say, well, look, I said something like that, you know, years ago or whatever. That, you know, again, that's a sort of post hoc reasoning that's not really acceptable. It's not a reliable avenue to knowledge. In any case, because of all the other reasons, again, just go right back to he lied about his credentials. You know, in academia, if you lie about your credentials, you're out. Your career's over. That's it. You know, you make up your data and you get caught, you're out. You're not going to be forgiven. You can't come back. It's just because so much of the system depends on the kind of internal trust within labs, within scientific communities, that, you know, we're playing by the rules that we've set up with fairly high standards of reasoning and evidence. And it's one thing to make a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. But when all the mistakes go in one particular direction, that's an indication of fraud. And then if something comes forward, like a graduate student or a whistleblower says, I saw him make up the data, or you get caught. In some cases, they've actually found the lab notes where they kind of just wrote in the data and then made mistakes, screwed up, and then they got caught the way they had made up the data. That's it. It's over. Game over. You can't come back. You can go find something else to do.
It depends where you are. It depends on the institution.
Yeah. Well, maybe in Russia.
Sometimes they take revenge with the whistleblowers.
Oh, well, that again, I mean, you, in the bad old days, yeah, whistleblowers were not trusted. But this is why we now have whistleblower laws, because enough of what whistleblowers have said turned out to be true, and that they were persecuted for coming forward, that now we have protections for them, which is why I think really, I don't know about Julian Assange, but Ed Snowden to me comes off with is super high integrity. Like, I really believe what he is saying. He doesn't seem to be doing it for any financial gain. He doesn't seem to want political power. He doesn't seem to be buying for anything. And I read his book. It's pretty damning for what he's exposing. And he doesn't seem to have any reason to do this other ulterior motive. And, you know, so why not treat him like a whistleblower? You know, this is a democracy. We're supposed to know about a lot of these things. I understand there's national secrets and so on, but a lot of the stuff he exposed, you know, we should have known about this. You know, warrantless searches, for example. What? I mean, the whole purpose of having to get a warrant is to protect citizens' privacies. Anyway, I think he should be brought back and not prosecuted. And actually, if anything, I think he's something of a hero.
So someone said that Trump might pardon him.
Well, we'll see. I don't know. if Ed Snowden could get himself to say something like Trump is the greatest president in the history of the world, maybe the universe, he probably would get a pardon.
Okay, so the other thing I wanted to discuss is the documentary Mirage Man by Mark Pilkington, where they talk about Richard Doughty. Richard Doughty was a government official that was tasked to feed false information, deceptive information to UFO researchers. And one of them was Paul Benowitz. And so this Benowitz guy was fed with so many fake information about UFOs and aliens that went crazy, and he was hospitalized, actually. And so this Richard Doughty says that this is part of the government strategy to cover up military devices. So let's say that there is some curious guy that is taking pictures in a restricted area, and then what we do is that we tell him, okay, look, these are UFOs, and this is the story, we're gonna give you information and so on, so that the information spreads virally to the UFO community.
Right. So sort of a false flag operation.
Yeah, kind of.
I haven't seen this film. I don't know the detail. I don't know this case at all.
That's why I was thinking, is it possible that maybe Bob Lazar was brought to a facility where they staged an alien spacecraft and they told him?
I don't know. Ask Bob Lazar. He may inculcate that into his memories.
It could be, yeah. Yeah. And so there is another person called Linda Howey that said that she provided evidence of a part of an alien spacecraft, a piece of metal, a layered metal with the bismuth, magnesium, zinc, silver. And she said, look, this is the evidence of an alien spacecraft. And they said, oh, we can't make this layered structure here on this planet, so it must be an alien spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, where is this?
She sold the piece of metal to Tom DeLonge. And,
yep, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
For $30,000.
Okay, all right. Let there we go. Right, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, Jacques Vallée, yeah. It's always the same people that are kind of in the loop here.
Yeah, same people, yes.
You know, again, external validation, like how about some independent lab that doesn't even know what it's supposed to be testing, doesn't know what the agenda is on the table here. How about having them test it? Also, before you say something is out of this world, let's first make sure that it's not in this world. The fact that a particular lab or individual can't identify it doesn't make it extraterrestrial. And again, maybe, some Russian, Chinese, lab somewhere made something that we don't know how to make. So what? That's still terrestrial.
Yeah, so other scientists said that maybe it's the residual of some industrial process. They spoke about the Betterton-Kroll process, which is something used to remove bismuth from lead. Or you can think about the Fordite. You see the Fordite, you say, what is this amazing thing? Which is that sort of mineral that you get where they spray paint cars. Paint keeps accumulating and then you get this mineral.
Yes, I have a paint job like that on my bicycle. It's called reflective paint, where it's different angles that you look at the bike. It's different, completely different colors. It's green from one angle, purple from another angle, because of the little particles in there. They're kind of sprayed on, and depending on the angle, it reflects different colors, color light. That's brand new. That was just invented like 3-4 years ago. And, so if you showed that to somebody 10 years ago, they'd go, oh, I don't know how that could possibly be made.
This is magic.
Therefore, extraterrestrial. Yeah, therefore magic. No. How about just, I don't know. Here's another principle of science. It's okay to say, I don't know. But this larger principle, before you say something is out of this world, first make sure it's not in this world. And, the little tailings or scrapings from machine shops, these are notorious UFO artifacts that turn out to be just, the slag left over from a machine shop. We have some in our office here that people have brought us that we took to a machinist. He goes, oh, I can make that for you. And he did. It's like, oh, all right. Even though the person holding it goes, I have no idea. So what? Reminds me of what we call the pyramid idiots, the people that say, I can't figure out how the pyramids were made, therefore extraterrestrial. In a way, it's just an argument from personal incredulity, because I can't think of how it was done, therefore it couldn't have been done by natural means. Maybe you just don't know enough, maybe, and it's possible nobody knows. Like you wanted to talk about Graham Hancock a little bit in ancient archaeology, so-called alternative archaeology, and the site of Göbekli Tepe. Well, we did a whole article in Skeptic on this. Very interesting. And it's interesting for mainstream scientific reasons, because allegedly monumental architecture has to be built by so-called advanced civilizations with large populations that have a division of labor, agriculture, metallurgy or advanced stone tool use, and have a large enough population to make something that massive. So here at Göbekli Tepe, you have a pretty impressive structure of tens of these stones that weigh tens of tons that a couple dozen people couldn't do, seemingly. But this was 11,000 years ago, so this is many, many thousands of years before agriculture really took off to the point where there was a division of labor and large populations living in cities that would give you the labor to construct something monumental like that. So how did they do it? You know, of course, now the ancient alien people are all excited about this. Graham is not one of those. He just thinks that there was an advanced terrestrial civilization, not extraterrestrial. They'll live many tens of thousands of years before our current understanding of when the first civilizations were, and that they're the ones that taught the hunter-gatherers how to do this. So the point is that this thing was, the structures at Göbekli Tepe were made by hunter-gatherers who we know lived in small communities of a couple dozen to a couple hundred people, not enough to move around those massive stone tools. So we think. My response when I read about it was, well, maybe we're just wrong about what hunter-gatherers can do. Maybe they're smarter and more sophisticated than we thought they were. And so why not start with that rather than, again, going to the extraterrestrial or super advanced ancient civilization? Because once you go down that route, if that's true, what else has to be true? There's another skeptic principle. If there was an advanced civilization that lived, say, 30,000 years ago, which is what Graham thinks, okay, where is their trash? Where are the homes? You know, where are their stone tools or metal tools? Where's their writing? Now, Graham's response to that is they didn't have any of that, because that's not what I mean by advanced. I mean, you know, mentally advanced or psychically advanced or wisdom advanced. Okay, but that's not how archaeologists use that word, advanced. They mean something else. You know, having an alphabet and a calendar and you know, metal tools, things like that. So I think that the real story of Göbekli Tepe and the mystery there is that we underestimated the power and intelligence and skills of ancient peoples. And that principle right there goes a long ways to answering all those ancient alien questions that began with Van Doniken, you know, Chariot of the Gods, and that launched an industry, a publishing industry, and then a kind of search the world for anything spooky and weird and mysterious that you can't explain. And again, just because you can't explain it doesn't mean that there isn't some archaeologist or art historian or something like that. You know, I really want to like the Ancient Aliens TV series on the History Channel, but it's just painful to watch. They never have a skeptic on. Occasionally they'll have on like a real archaeologist or art historian or somebody that actually knows something, but they don't ask them to address the particular thing that they're addressing in the show. Okay, how did that thing there in South America, 10,000 feet elevation of Cusco, Machu Picchu, how did that get made? And then that person, well, here's what archaeologists think that is how it was made. They never do that. They always have the expert just kind of repeat what the problem is. Or this was a magnificent site, and here's where it's located. And then they go to what's his name with the goofy hair? Yeah, the guy that says, I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. give us at least the mainstream scientists think it is. And then go ahead and give us your ancient alien thing. The reason they don't do that, I think, is because they can see that the mainstream explanation is always better than the extraterrestrial explanation. And they never have any positive evidence. Again, it's always the argument from ignorance or the argument from personal incredulity. I can't imagine how they moved those stones so big. They could not have done it through natural means. How do you know?
And one of the things that you discussed during that podcast, in particular, Hancock and Carson brought up several published papers supporting two things. One was the asteroid or comet impact 13,000 years ago, and there are several publications in Science and other top journals. And the other one was the pre-Clovis occupation of America.
Yeah, so the impact hypothesis has gathered some more support since that podcast. The one you're referring to, by the way, is that's the Joe Rogan podcast with Graham Hancock and Carlson and myself. And then we each had our own phone a friend expert. The impact hypothesis at that time was, you know, it was sort of hit and miss. Since then, there's been a few other papers in support, although there are some skeptics. That find in San Diego that week was made that week that Graham Hancock brought up about the mammoth burial mammoth site in San Diego that was dated 130,000 years ago. Now, the paper claimed that the bones were broken in such a way, and there were some rocks around there that might have been stone tools, would imply that humans or some kind of hominid broke the bones in a way to get to the marrow, and therefore people lived in North America 130,000 years ago. Okay, wow. I mean, if that were true, that would completely overturn Clovis. Well, that is not what the pre-Clovis archaeologists think at all. You know, they think instead of 11 to 13,000 years, roughly 13, say, it's more like maybe 18 or 20, 22. You know, you sort of push the boundaries depending on the site, plus or minus the error bars on the dates, you know, and that's the that's the real challenge to Clovis. Since that podcast, there's, again, more evidence for pre-Clovis. So Clovis is probably gone now. Fine. But, you know, I got hammered for being kind of the defender of the orthodoxy, as it were. But the reason that orthodoxy was there, it was because of, you know, almost a century's worth of research to support it. Now, that doesn't make the orthodoxy permanently right. You know, as Einstein famously said in response to a book called 100 Scientists Against Einstein, he said, why do we need 100? You know, one would do if I'm wrong. And that's right. So, you know, again, falsification is key. And, you know, finding older sites consistently, particularly as they spread down North America, you know, such that, you know, the native initial Americans coming over didn't have to fly down to South America. You know, so, in other words, there's kind of a tracing record down the coast or whatever, to see how they got to South America with those older dates. Now, the impact hypothesis, it's still what part what's instilled under dispute is the mass extinction of the, all the native mammals. There's still some you know, scientists claiming that the impact itself is not enough to explain that, because not all species went extinct, and other species went extinct that were not affected by the impact. So at the very least, it's probably overhunting hypothesis, and maybe, you know, the weakening of the populations because of the decimation due to the impact, something like that. And there has been a paper published challenging the San Diego paper in Nature. And so people can read it and decide. For me, I'm just going to say, you know, I doubt it. That's the extraordinary claim. Therefore, we need a lot of evidence to overturn it. Like, where were the people 100,000 years ago then? There should be sites that are 120,000 years old, 115,000 years old, 110,000 years old. In other words, there should be a record between here and there. But to jump from these kind of pre-Clovis claims of maybe 20, 25,000 years old to 130,000 years old with nothing in between, that makes me skeptical. And also, it's good to remember that the site was discovered because it was construction with heavy equipment driving over the bones that are in the dirt not far below. So another hypothesis is that the bones were broken because of the heavy equipment. And the stone tools, these are not like these beautifully crafted Clovis stones that are obviously artificially produced. They're just kind of broken in a way that, you know, if you squint and use your imagination, maybe it was made by a person, but, you know, maybe not. And also 130,000 years ago, who would that be? I mean, Neanderthals maybe, or, you know, Denisovians, you know. Okay. So now we're off the page of science and we're just kind of speculating. It's fun. Super interesting. I like Graham. By the way, he's a really good writer. I like his books. I've read most of his books, and I like that he's there doing that, because science does need its outsiders. It needs people to challenge the orthodoxy. As long as you're willing to say, usually the outsiders and the challengers, even inside challengers to the orthodoxy, are wrong. They're usually wrong. So it's, you know, the reason science is so conservative and careful and cautious is because most ideas that scientists come up with are wrong. You know, they're in the lab, they're just spitballing ideas, and so let's just see what we can come up with and then test it and see what happens. Again, back to Einstein, you know, he wasn't world famous until after 1919, when Eddington tested his general theory of relativity with the bending of starlight around the sun during the solar eclipse. Before that, no one knew who Einstein was outside of physics. In physics, he was pretty famous, but outside of that, you know, he was nobody. And he was mostly famous because of those five papers he wrote in 1905 that, you know, proved the existence of molecules and in the Brownian motion paper and a few other things that caught the attention of the professional community, and it got him a real job. But that isn't what made him famous. What made him famous was, here's an actual experiment that confirmed it. Exact, almost to the perfect exact point that he said it would. Okay, that's what it takes.
Which is something that those string theory guys would need now, probably.
I get these letters here. Here's one I just got today. You know, this big package full of stuff, you know, and all these little clippings and notes and folded papers. You know, it's a theory of physics. And, you know, Einstein was wrong and Newton was wrong and Hawking was wrong. And I've been working on it in my garage my whole life, and I got it all figured out. Okay, I really don't have to read it. You know, the chances of this, you know, guy overturning all that is pretty much nil.
I got some of those guys on LinkedIn. It happened to me as well.
That's right. You're a physicist, right?
Yeah.
So you probably get those letters too.
Yeah. So another thing I forgot to mention before was going back to the UFOs. This is very important, I think. David Hambling, who is a journalist based in the UK here, wrote an interesting article about USA Navy laser creates plasma UFO. There was a patent in 2018 where they describe a decoy system for fighter jets that basically works with the laser. So the laser ionizes the air, and then it raster scans in that region, and then it creates an image, an hologram basically. And this hologram can be in different frequencies. It can be in the visible, in the infrared, in the UV. So this thing can be picked up by other missiles. It can be picked up by people can see it. So this guy was saying, well, and I think this is a good explanation, that maybe what these people are seeing is just a hologram. This is nothing weird. But if that's the case, the government is not going to tell you that this is a hologram, because this is the decoy system, so they wouldn't want you to know. And this is not something fancy, it's not weird, it's something that it's within physics. So, but go and prove it, right? So even that, you need to prove it, right? Another thing I wanted to ask you is about the connection between UFOs and transcendental meditation. Why there seems to be a connection between these two things? There is another guy that talks about summoning aliens, so he's got this protocol that he can use to call aliens.
Right. Again, to me, it's just more hand-waving for why they don't have physical evidence for their claims. Well, they're interdimensional beings. They're spiritual beings, not physical beings. You know, in science fiction, there's kind of this trend. It's sort of an evolutionary model that humans evolve eventually to having larger and larger brains, thinner, you know, rail thin bodies that are kind of weak, which is why aliens always look like these bulbous head with thin little arms and so on. But if you project it out, you know, eventually, and this is, you know, kind of science fiction really, is that we're just pure spirit. You know, you upload your mind into the cloud and there you are. You know, this is an actual scenario that some people think we can achieve immortality by uploading your connectome, the map of all your neural connections, into the equivalent of the cloud, whatever that would be, and there you are, you're up there. No, you wouldn't be up there. You're still there. It would just be a copy. It's not you. In any case, it's not even a person. But the idea is that, you know, far future advanced extraterrestrials or far future humans will just be spiritual in nature. We'll shed our bodies because, you know, even if you're chronically frozen and brought back, your body is still just protein. It's going to break down. Or even if you uploaded your mind into the cloud, but there still has to be some servers or something that holds the memory. It's a giant file. It has to be stored somewhere. You know, you still need some medium that could be destroyed, you know. So the next logical step in the fantasy, if we want to call it that, is that you're just pure spirit, like soul, You know, so this gets to the idea of ensoulment, you know, the ghost in the machine. There's just something about us that's non-material. You know, this is that kind of Platonic idea, you know, Descartes' dualism, where there's the physical stuff, then there's the mental stuff, whatever that is, but it's not physical. So I, you know, the connection you're looking for there, it's not just transcendental meditation people, but anybody that believes in a kind of a dualistic nature that has kind of a sci-fi fantasy prone personality can, you know, dream up a you know, a scenario like that.
Yeah, and what do you think these Eastern cults or religions are so attractive to people in the West? Is it because we killed the God and that's why we look for these kind of things in the East?
Particularly the West Coast of the United States, particularly California where I'm at. we are seeing a kind of resurgence again of alternative spiritualities and religions, with the decline of mainstream religions. We saw this in the 60s, you know, when Catholicism, you know, started to lose its muster. And then, you know, then we saw a kind of resurgence of Presbyterianism and Baptists and evangelical Christianity. But that's been waning the last 10, well, about 15, 20 years now. And now we've seen the rise of the nuns. So there's one idea in atheist humanist circles that, you know, we need to replace religion with something. Now, I don't personally think we do. I think humanism is just fine the way it is. I don't think we need to bolt on any kind of Eastern mysticism to make it palatable. But the idea is that people need whatever it is religion offers.
The spirituality,
you know,
right?
Building to go to, spirituality or community. Now, first of all, the community thing I get, you know, we're a social species. We like to be with other people of our kind, whatever that is politically or, you know, bowling league or whatever. In my case, my cycling buddies, you know, we like to be with people that, you know, we enjoy the similar ideas or activities. Okay. And religion does offer something like that. You know, a place to go once a week to kind of, you know, recharge your batteries spiritually, whatever that means, to people individually. And you're with people you like because they're similar to you religiously and now politically because politics and religion are so intertwined. And plus they offer free parking.
Okay.
So California, that's big. Yeah. The church has free parking and free babysitting too. You know, so, you know, there is a movement afoot in humanist circles, humanist atheist circles, to build the equivalent of churches, you know, a building to go to every week with your fellow humanist or atheists and affirm your beliefs in civil rights and civil liberties and pro-choice and women's rights and gay rights, whatever it is. That's fine. Okay. I don't have any problems with that. But that's not really religion. Okay. I mean, religion is a big word, but it has to mean something. And if everything is religion, then nothing is a religion and it loses meaning as a word. So in terms of like what humans need, you know, religion is too broad an explanation. You know, there's psychologists who study, you know, the need for transcendence. Now, this could be anything. You could go on a hike by yourself or just with one other person out in the woods for a couple of days, you know, and that's a transcendent experience. Or maybe you get it through dance or meditation. I know, you know, a lot of people are really into meditation now. You know, there's kind of the Deepak Chopra type, kind of Western Buddhism, or you could go the Sam Harris, you know, pure secular meditation. A lot of people do that kind of meditation. Deepak has huge following, a gigantic following. Millions of people do that kind of meditation. And we would not call them religious. I mean, I don't think anybody would go, boy, those are religious nuts or anything like that. Not at all. So maybe that's what will happen, you know, something along those lines. You know, walks on the beach, you know, weekly walks on the beach. It's a little bit like Jews have their, you know, Shabbat every week, you know, from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. And really, what is it? It's a time to just like get off the internet. Don't check Twitter for 24 hours. It's the equivalent of that. You know, there are people like my friend Dave Rubin. He takes all of August off. He goes offline. He doesn't answer emails, nothing. You know, and it's kind of the same thing as that. You know, we might see the evolution of something like that.
The other thing I wanted to discuss was the water memory and the homeopathy. So what do you think when this sort of Well, that's considered a pseudoscience now, because many countries have recognized that homeopathy is basically a fraud, kind of. It's a multi-billion industry, and there have been some papers in the past, even in Nature. And but then the problem is that in this case, this pseudoscience involves medicine.
Yeah, it's not medicine. This is why it's not regulated. It's in the United States anyway. It's considered a food product. So in terms of like what the FDA regulates, as long as you're not poisoning people, and you know, homeopathy doesn't do anything, right? It's by definition an inert substance that's come in contact with the allegedly curative substance, and it has the memory of it in its molecules, whatever that means. And so as far as the government regulatory agencies are concerned, it's harmless. It's like taking mega vitamins or whatever, as long as you don't, you know, hurt anybody, who cares? It's not right. So it's not a medicine that has to meet the higher standards. And this is how they get around that. You know, this is, and there's, you know, just countless, you know, thousands, ten, I don't know, millions of products in that category that are not medicines. And they even say, usually say on the box, this is not a medicine, doesn't treat, you know, a medical, see your doctor and so on. They have those warnings on there because they've probably been sued or warned that they're making claims beyond what they can make as a food product or supplement.
Yeah, I remember James Randi doing the show where he ingested, I don't know, many, he overdosed with the sleeping pills.
Yeah, well, because it doesn't do anything. So, and again, with anecdotal thinking, though, you know, if you're sick and all of a sudden you get better, whatever you did just before you got better, that's what gets the credit.
Yeah, but
so it doesn't have to be homeopathy. It could be acupuncture, or acupressure, or some Chinese medicine, or you know, meditation, anything really.
I think the problem comes when you take when you go for these remedies instead of taking real medicines.
Yeah, so when it's alternative to a medicine you actually need, that's when it's dangerous.
In your book, Skeptic, you mentioned that 40% of Americans believe in ESP. In a 2002. Basically, there was a study revealing that apparently there is no correlation between science knowledge and paranormal belief. How is that?
Yeah, so, and this is held up recently with postmodern beliefs and the idea that we're living in a post-truth world and you know, there's climate denial and anti-vaccinations and so on. Turns out that having scientific knowledge or having had courses in science does next to nothing to sort of protect your beliefs from these alternative and wrong, usually wrong beliefs. So it's not having scientific facts themselves that's going to do it. It's really teaching people how to think about claims. And this is why I teach my course, Skepticism 101, How to Think Like a Scientist. This I teach at Chapman University, and you can get the course on the great courses, teaching companies great courses. And, you know, most of my books are oriented toward this. What I'm trying to do is not tell you what to think about UFOs or psychics or astrology or conspiracy theories. It's how to think about them, because I don't know what's going to come down the pike that's going to be popular in a decade from now. I have no idea. But I want you to be equipped with certain tools like we've been talking about. Again, before you say something's out of this world, first make sure that it's not in this world. The burden of proof is not on you to disprove. It's on the claimant to prove. You know, extraordinary evidence, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Yeah, there's my books there, which I present those principles. So the idea is that I think the solution to this post-truth world we're supposedly living in, we're not, is to teach people how to think. When you hear some particular claim, it could be a politician or an economist or some pundit on a radio talk show. You know, how do we know that's true? Just ask some basic questions. Where does that claim come from? Did anybody fact check it? You know, I've been impressed with, since the 2016 election, the rise of in importance of sites like PolitiFact and Snopes and our own Skeptic. That, you know, these are fact-checking sites. And in some cases, like whenever Trump gives a speech, they have a team of fact-checkers right there in real time, you know, posting whether what he just said is true or not. And, you know, then they rate it on a scale of 1 to 5. I think, you know, the biggest lies are, you know, the Pinocchio, you know, pants on fire or whatever, the long nose rating, you know, they, different sites have different methods of this, but that tells us there's a market for that, that people actually want to know, they care about the truth. And that's the solution to the problem. So when someone denies climate or they accept climate, probably neither one of them, climate science, I mean, probably neither one of them knows much about climate science. I mean, it's a technical field. I don't know much about it. It's not my area. But what you're doing is signaling to your tribe that you acknowledge the value of science and that it's a hard-earned, supported consensus science. Or you're signaling to your tribe that you doubt it because it's so politicized. You know, since Al Gore's film, Inconvenient Truth, you know, kind of popularized climate science, and he was a, you know, the Democratic vice president. So that made climate science a liberal, you know, connection, a claim. Therefore, conservatives sort of feel like they have to be against it, even though they don't know anything about it. But neither does the person on the other side. You know, so we're signaling for other reasons. Call it virtue signaling.
Basically, the question was why people believe weird things. That's an old book that you wrote in 1995.
And that was my first book. There's the cover, right? Sorry. There.
This one.
There we go. Yeah, that's my latest book. Yeah, so why people believe weird things. Yeah, so this really, I'm a psychologist, you know, by training and historian of science. I'm interested in why people believe the claims they do, as well as whether the claims are true or not. So I have kind of a dual role as the publisher of Skeptic. And in both cases, you know, I think they're both important, you know, whether the claim is true or not, and then why people believe it, particularly when it's apparent that it's not true. So that's what I focus on. And again, it's, you know, it's social, it's virtue signaling, it's signaling to your social tribe. You know, there's a lot of these extra evidentiary factors at work in why people believe.
And you go a lot into politics in your latest book. And maybe we can talk about politics another time if you have time. This time I wanted to focus mainly on pseudoscience.
We'll do that for my next book. I want to do on what's truth. How do you know it's true? Well, that applies to politics, economics, ideology, morality. You know, I'm a realist. I want to live in the world of facts, and I think scientific facts can inform at least even moral questions.
But apparently there are people that think that truth is subjective. There is no, that's a problem with the relativism.
They tend to be on the left, and that's worrisome to me, because that kind of, first of all, reinforces the, you know, conservative, Christian conservative right, that there are you know, these supernatural given divine command morals. But that's wrong. They're wrong about that. But that doesn't mean, therefore, everything is relative and there are no real moral values. There's just opinions people have and cultural shifts and changes that happen. You know, slavery was popular and now it's condemned, but maybe it'll be accepted again someday. Who knows? It's all just relative. No, I disagree with that. Anyway, I argue that I have a couple essays in that book you just held up, Giving the Devil His Due, arguing against that particular claim, that relativist claim.
So cold fusion is, first of all, let's say what is proper fusion. Fusion is what happens in the sun, that you have atoms that merge together and then they release extreme amounts of energies. And that's how the sun burns, basically. We can reproduce this on Earth with hydrogen bombs, but also with the nuclear reactors, tokamaks, for example. But there are people that claim that these things can be done at room temperature, basically. There was a paper in 1989, and now there is this guy called Andrea Rossi who is trying to sell a device called ECAT. The interesting thing about this device is that the Australian skeptics basically asked the guy if they could inspect the device, but the guy said, no, I'm not going to allow you to inspect the device. And they offered him $1 million, I think $1 million for that. And the guy said, no.
Yep, that's a red flag. You claim to have a device that gives you energy too cheap to meter, it's going to save the world and so on. That was the claim made about cold fusion. But at least to their credit, Pons and Fleischmann said, go ahead and test it. Here's how we did it. and then no one could replicate it. And they realized it was just a chemical reaction, not a nuclear reaction, and a story. But their mistake was to hold the press conference first and make promises that, you know, we're going to change the world before the replication. Now, most of the perpetual motion machine people, you know, they don't even want to be tested because, you know, they know their game is up then.
Quantum quackery mysticism. Why do you think people, again, want to merge mysticism with quantum mechanics?
Yeah, well, quantum physics is spooky and weird and consciousness is spooky and weird, so they must be connected.
Okay.
You know, how about no? How about there's just a lot of spooky and weird things out there? Doesn't mean they're necessarily connected. And we will have an explanation for consciousness that you know, neuroscientists are working on that. There's some interesting ideas there. Or maybe it's conceptually the wrong question to ask. You know, it may just be a brute fact of nature that consciousness exists, full stop, whatever it is, who knows. But that has nothing to do with quantum physics. Quantum physics, you know, as far as I know, is, you know, very, very, very well supported. And but it's in the realm of the subatomic. It's not at the macro level, although there are some claims that you can get some quantum effects at the macro level. Okay, then what does quantum mean if it's at the macro level? Anyway, that's a different story. But in terms of what you're asking is, you know, again, as soon as there's something super interesting and weird in the physical sciences, it isn't long before people in psychology or social psychology or whatever glom onto it, or particularly in ESP research, looking for some causal explanation. Now, the part of the problem is there's nothing to explain. You know, people cannot read other people's minds. People cannot read the backs of playing cards. They cannot do any of those ESP paranormal psi type phenomenon that therefore needs an explanation like quantum physics. There's nothing to explain because they can't do it.
Do you remember the documentary, What the Bleep?
Yeah, What the Bleep Do We Know? Yeah, of course I saw it and we reviewed that and I wrote about it. Yeah, it's the same thing. There's nothing to explain beyond statistical chance and randomness and coincidence and so on that are alleged to be mysteries that need some kind of spooky explanation. No explanation is needed because there's nothing that needs explaining.
Funding research on weird things. Let's say that you are having a panel of peer reviewers and someone comes to you and they tells you, okay, we're looking for funding for this specific project, but that project is a bit weird. So how would you judge? How do you balance between too much skeptic and being on the other side? Where is the balance?
Well, so first of all, funding. You know, private funding agencies can do whatever they want. You know, Bill Gates can fund whatever he wants, or the Templeton Foundation, fund whatever they want. And so if they want to fund paranormal research, okay, fine. I'm not going to object to that. Although I will say that particular area has been researched now for well over a century, and there's still nothing to sink your teeth into. You know, there was the last big one was BEMS. Research from, what was that, 2010, 2011, of the, you know, backward causality about extrasensory perception of, you know, anticipating what's going to appear on the screen, this computer screen that was hidden, and that the people could do it slightly more better than chance. Well, turns out there was, you know, some methodological problems. He ran 9 experiments, but only reported 2 of them. Well, why didn't you report the other 7? Because they didn't come out as significant. So it's called the file drawer problem, which is emblematic of another larger problem in the replication crisis, is that, you know, experimenters start off in one direction and then change their mind and do something else, and then report it as if that something else was what they planned to do all along. But they went down that route in the first place because the original one wasn't going anywhere. But again, file drawer problem. We don't get to read about that. So now there's Stuart Ritchie has a great book about this that just came out it's called Science Fictions. And it's really great. He, the last chapter outlines what has to be done. Like there's these common websites now where you post the research you're going to conduct. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to run these 6 experiments and here's how I'm going to do it. And I will report the results of all of them. So none of this cherry picking your data, you know, or throwing out the high and low scores to make it come out statistically significant and so on. And that's a good corrective for that problem. But it really began with the BEM. the ESP experiment. And that's the last one anyone's come up with that's, you know, kind of made a public notice that ESP might be real. So you're talking since the, you know, the 1880s or so, when the two psychical societies, one in England and one in the United States, started conducting experiments. I mean, and they, you know, these were real scientists trying to do really good research. You know, that's where the Zener cards were invented, for example. And you know, so here we are, we got 130, 140 years of experiments, and still we got nothing. So why would you spend any more money on that? I mean, you know, spend money on, you know, how to improve batteries for electric cars, or, you know, something that's going to be a little more useful and have some results. You know, in other words, I'm not against it. Go look for Bigfoot if you want. But, you know, the fact that people have been searching for Bigfoot for centuries now, and we still don't have a body, probably means he's not out there.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.